Saving money on your next project now at Menards. Menards is the leading supplier of quality roof and floor trusses. Choose from our large selection of residential and post-frame trusses or design custom trusses specifically for your project. Get started on your building project today, in-store or on Menards.com. Plus, view our weekly flyer for all the great deals happening now. Save big money
at Menards. This is The Big Breakdown, a long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Drake.
Moving on to Nancy Guthrie once again, because there's so much chaos that continues to surround this case and around these ransom notes. So while Nancy Guthrie is still missing after 6 months, one criminal case has actually closed recently, and it's not about her disappearance. A California man pleaded guilty to sending her family fake ransom texts demanding Bitcoin, milking a grieving family's worst hours for a sick game with nobody on the other end. Retired Special Agent Jennifer Coffendeffer will hopefully join us again because she's been back. Jen, I'm doing your intro. We are bouncing to Nancy Guthrie and talking about the ransom notes, talking about the California guy who just pleaded guilty for sending the family fake ransom texts. And so Jennifer's joined us to talk about what this actually means and what a 5-year probation offer of tormented family mid-search has actually, what's that cause to the investigation, to the family and everything else. And so Jen, welcome back again. What do you make of this conviction?
Well, the conviction isn't what bothers me. What bothers me is the plea deal. And the plea deal to plead him down to only a harassment charge, which is only punishable in the federal system by 2 years, this particular charge. And then to plead him down, at least the plea agreement, unless he messes up, it's going to stand, is a 5-year probation. And they're stacked on top of each other. So it's not 10 years, it's only 5 years for both counts. And I think it's a travesty. I really do, because it sets a precedent in this case, a case where so many others are doing this exact same activity, as TMZ as well pointed out.
Yeah, so what does this do to the investigators? So here are the investigators. They're still doggedly going after this, trying to flush out every little last minuscule of whatever leads they do have. And then you have this thing come around, and you have someone who's created noise and a drain of resources, personnel, and investigative tools, techniques, and things you're working on is nothing but a fraud. And so then they're not even punished to the full extent they can be. What does this do to the investigators' morale? What's it do to other leads come in? What's the overall impact?
Well, it's a huge impact, because if I'm looking at this from the FBI's point of view, and I guarantee those agents that worked on that are so irritated. I've been in those shoes so many times where you put the case together and then you have the prosecutor's office decide, listen, we're going to get our two convictions and we're going to move along. This is white collar. This is a situation where it's not violent. He didn't threaten anyone, right? He just asked for Bitcoin. So when you look at all that, I'm just trying to present both sides of the pancake. That's right. the lawyer side. But the agent side is saying, whoa, wait, why are we spending likely hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars trying to figure out who sent those, I call them the TMZ 12, the 12 extortion notes, if they're going to get probation? Because now the judge has set the precedent. And it's going to be the same jurisdiction. They could get a different federal judge, but it's a mess.
So how do you think they were able to do this fast on this one guy when you look at Porch Guy, and granted, you know, a lot of people, including yourself, think there's other people involved that might have three marbles rolling around upstairs, not just one of the Porch Guy, you know. What made them be able to trace this guy down so fast and not actually one of the legit ones, if there are any legit ones? Because I want to get into that as well. Like, where do we stand on all these notes? Because it feels like every day I got a timestamp everything I'm seeing coming across the news feeds, because I don't know which is the most current on where we're standing on these notes. But to my first question, how do you think they were able to track this one down so fast and nothing else?
Oh, well, this was an easy no-brainer case. Kalela He is not a bright bulb. He decided to use his devices that directly go to him, and he flanked the messages by messages that would only be made by him. And he used a voice, VoIPA, to make it, and then it transitioned to text. So he basically made the most simple roadmap for any agent to be able to quickly put together this case. So it's so easy. But in the other situations, you have likely VPNs being used, likely Proton emails, possibly even a public email server. You have a lot of roadblocks that are not, you know, affording the FBI the ability to figure it out.
Right. And so I want to go then to the second of my two questions in one, which is never what you should do. And that is, so can you actually iron out for us all where we are on all these notes again? So, because I'm seeing, you know, insiders inside the FBI saying none of the notes are legit, then the FBI is saying we're still investigating these notes, but you seem to have a much cleaner pulse on what's going on. Are there legit notes that they still are investigating or not? And if so, how many? What's your take on all that right now?
Okay, so we have the TMZ 12, which are extortion notes, not to be confused with ransom notes. Those people didn't come in and say they did anything to Nancy Guthrie. They just came in and said, we know what happened and we can find her for you and give you information about it, right? Totally extortive information. So those are them. That leaves us with the two other notes. So there was another note. I should say, let me make this crystal clear. The first notes that were sent to two local Tulsa stations in conjunction with TMZ. And those were the notes that said, listen, 4 million or else if not by that date, we're going to up it to 6 million. And if you don't give it to us by that date, we're going to kill Nancy. So those are the first notes.
And I love your distinction here. This helps a lot. So we're calling those the two original ransom notes, correct?
Well, I'm calling that the original ransom note. Yep. Really, there's only been one ransom note, and that's that
the first
note.
Right.
The second note I call an apology note. They don't ask for money. They don't ask for the ransom. They don't say anything other than we're sorry, she died. It was an accident. We didn't mean it to happen. Mea culpa, which I think they did for self-serving reasons. That note, however, and this is a big distinction, only went to the two local Tucson stations. That did not go to TMZ. And this is a big distinction because it's caused a lot of confusion because TMZ has said, well, wait a minute. You know, we didn't have anything that said that. Well, they didn't get anything that said that because the apology went to the local stations. And so that is what happened there. So where's the FBI on this? The FBI, in my opinion, they made it crystal clear that the TMZ 12, which they describe as extortion notes, are likely not legitimate or words to that effect. Right. In other words, the person doesn't have any knowledge. They're just doing what so many of these horrible people do, and that is try to get money out of a grieving family. But the other two notes, they've made it clear that they are, quote unquote, investigating, and they have not made their determination, but they are investigating them as being legitimate. In other words, they're spending their time because they believe they could be legitimate. So they quickly, to me, it was a slap in the face to Reuters that came out and did this blanket statement that they're all bad. The FBI, who has only said anything about this case three times, and this is one of them where they said, no, not so fast. And we don't even know if it was an FBI official. I mean, and is it an FBI official that's three step removed, you know, at the barbershop? He makes some statement. I mean, you just don't even know.
I know every time you watch things like this and, you know, they never ask the investigators because we're never allowed to talk to anyone. It always goes to the public affairs office of the local field office that's handling it. And they get their statements from the executive who's four steps removed from the actual investigation, might not have been briefed on it, or they just bounce right up to headquarters who doesn't even know anything anyway. So yeah, so I'm always amazed by what actually comes out from these things. So with that, I got a follow-up question to this too, because this is really, I love how you draw the distinction between ransom notes and extortion notes and where those went. That actually helped me a lot because I've been tracking it, but you've been much closer on it. So how do investigators in this case, because I guarantee you you're probably getting even more noise coming in for going for that celebrity notoriety of sending a note in and seeing if they get a response. So how are investigators right now identifying copycats as opposed to the real deal here, do you think?
Well, the number one thing, if you look at those first two communications, right, the ransom and the apology, they are joined together. If we're to believe Howard Bloom, he said that they are joined by the same IP address. Mm-hmm. That was, to me, the biggest news that came out during this time frame. I was like, wow. So now.
And we just lost her again.
Oh, good. But I see where she's going with it. So, and Howard Bloom, for everyone that's listening. So Howard Bloom, he wrote, he does a lot of investigative journalism on, I think it's InMail. Anyway, he wrote the book the very first book about the Koberger case. And when the night comes falling, as a matter of fact, we interviewed him, Tony and I did on our show here, very, very good, thorough investigative reporter. So when Howard Bloom says something, I tend to give it a little more credence. And so having those two come from that one IP address definitely was really a good filter for anything else that comes in after that. So good on us for that one. What I was going to ask Jen next, and hopefully she'll be back with us in a second, was really about whether this conviction actually helps investigators build momentum or it hinders their momentum on the investigation. What are you thinking, Todd?
I mean, it's so tough because this is a very interesting investigation. There seems to have been so many missteps along the way. And I think a lot of times when you look at police investigations, maybe even FBI, you think there's a step process, A, B, C, D. And this one has just kind of gone all over the place. So I guess my thought process on that is maybe in a typical situation, it may be a hindrance, but maybe in this case, it's actually a help. Jen's back with us, so she can answer your question if you reiterate it to her.
Yeah, perfect. So Jen, the question I had for Todd is like, all right, so the FBI's created these filters, hopefully, you know, by this IP address, because I was giving Howard Bloom a lot of credit here, because we had him on the show months ago because he did the book on the Koberger case and when the night comes falling based on his investigative work. And so I tend to give that a lot of credit. So my question was, do you think with this conviction and this maybe filter of the IP addresses, does this build momentum for investigators, or was this noise that distracts them, do you think?
Well, I truly think that even though they have an IP address, I think it's just been a dead end for them for the reasons I mentioned before, which I figured early on, because this should not take this long in terms of figuring out who sent those communications. But it is going to take that long when you have those details I just discussed, right? The details concerning if they used a VPN, if they used public Wi-Fi, if they used a Proton address, right? All of those things are huge roadblocks. I mean, my hope is that they actually used an email address that might be of foreign nature, and that they are working to cooperate with a foreign government, like, for instance, Switzerland is a big one, right. Germany is a big one, that possibly, that will lead to something. So it's complicated. It just is so complicated, and it's going to take time. I really thought by 6 months we would have something, but we don't yet.
Are you seeing any progress from your optic and what you've been covering? And in that same vein, are they still pursuing as a main lead and main area the wrench attacks that you've covered so thoroughly?
You know, I still, that is just something that it's confusing to me, because, you know, I keep asking myself about that second letter, the apology letter, and then it really doesn't comport with the wrench attack. And then I was like, well, you know what? It doesn't comport with anybody taking somebody and threatening to murder them. It doesn't comport with any of that. So, you know, it's a strange situation. And it doesn't it just smell like that second letter? To me, I really do believe that it's likely AI that was used. You know, how do I write a letter to apologize for murdering somebody in a kidnapping? You know, just the verbiage throughout the whole thing. People have said it seems female. I don't think it seems female. I think it seems contrived.
Yeah, it's interesting because I'm not dying on any hills with this one, but that second letter to me indicates behaviorally, I'll be very clear. It indicates from their own language, it wasn't the intent for her to die. And so, but I take that a step further on my end is I don't think it was the intent to take her at all. Because I'm still on the 50-50 in the world of maybe on what the true intent of this was, because the true intent was to make money and profit off of doing whatever they're going to do in that house, and everything fell apart. But like you said, that second letter is so puzzling, without a doubt.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, I feel very confident that this was a kidnap for ransom, purposeful. Yep. But I'm going to say why I say that. It's because the FBI has said that. One of the few things they've come out and said anything about, and that's what they've said, is in writing, we are investigating this as a kidnap for ransom. And as you know, even to open a case, you're going to have to predicate it. And you're going to have to predicate it with the details of why you're opening this as a kidnapping matter as opposed to something else, a home invasion or something else. And so it is that reason that I just feel very confident that their evidence shows a kidnap for ransom and that they believe those first two notes have some authenticity.
So I'd love to explore this one because you have more experience on this, on the investigative side, on the criminal side. So they use a language, they're investigating as if it's a kidnapping for ransom. So not saying they believe it's kidnapping for ransom, as if gives that wobble room. So investigatively, Jen, do they have more tools available to them if they're investigating it as a kidnapping for ransom as opposed to if it was a home invasion for a robbery?
I saw it.
No. Actually, everything's going to be the same. So it's irrelevant it's totally irrelevant how they open the matter. They're going to have the resources available to them. But, it's puzzling to me because I just don't think they would throw it out there. And I agree with you that it's not like I'm stealing this from Mac McCollum.
Right.
It's not like this was a marriage that was made. In other words, I'm 100% in. It's more like I'm pretty much in, but I could be a little out.
Right, because they keep giving us wobble words, you know, as if, you know, maybes, you know, and when you live in that world. So it sounds like they're hedging their bets and keeping it all open as well.
Jen, I wanted to ask you, yeah. I mean, you've been, Jen, through this entire process, you've been pretty confident in coming to some resolution with where Nancy is, or at least finding out what happened. You seem to be a little bit discouraged at this point. You said earlier that you thought at 6 months we'd have more. How discouraged are you? Are you thinking we're ever going to figure this out? Are you thinking that maybe this is going to be one of the mysteries of all time?
I still think that they will figure this out, but I truly believe that I'm totally discouraged, to be honest.
Yeah.
Because I just don't see a road that seems to be happening right now. We've got the DNA, but DNA is going to take months and months and months. And so because of that, I don't think that that's a road that's going to lead to anything anytime soon. And I'm not even convinced it's going to lead to anything, to be honest with you. The hair is transient, meaning you can have a hair end up in your house for any number of reasons. And then the other DNA, I think there's a lot we don't know about other DNA. But, you know, from my view, something should have broken by now. The other thing that bothers me is why in the world, unless they know who Porch Guy is and they're building a case, why aren't they doing more to find him? You know, I was just on with an attorney, and he said that you actually, in Arizona, it's an Arizona case, can set up roadblocks and you can put Porch Guy's face on it and stop every single car.
Good point.
It was a case that held up under case law when they did this on another case, trying to solve a murder.
What do you think now, is keeping them from doing things like this?
That is the puzzling thing. You know, why don't you have billboards? Why don't you put it in Spanish? It's only one of two reasons. One, you know who he is. Or two, you're incompetent.
And do you think that is, Jen? Do you think it's because they know who it is or because they're incompetent?
You know, I cannot believe that our, you know, that the Bureau is incompetent in this way. I just can't believe that with, you know, we've been gone 10 years now, Robin, but it's hard for me to believe that. But I talked about this, how when we were in the entire, you know, everything was about crime. And then after 9/11 happened, everyone shifted over to counterterrorism, which is your world, a world that is kind of chasing ghosts in a way, meaning you do not put them on trial. You're trying right. to get your that is not the function of what you're doing. And so I worried back then, and we all talked about it. Is the next generation coming up and getting trained? Are they getting trained? Are they working extortions, kidnappings, and gangs and violent crime? Sure they are, but to much less extent. And that's why Kash Patel, he's changed the whole thing back to how it was. He's doing both, but you know, he even loosened up how you could get in, right? Getting in the Bureau. No polygraphs for some people. I know. Don't get me started. Don't get me started. I did a whole tweet on that too when it came out. I was so disappointed. I don't know. But I think he realizes there aren't enough people with that type of experience, and he's pulling in those people. That's another reason why I say this. Look at what he's done. He said, listen, if you're a cop or whatever, we're not going to polygraph you. Well, I don't know. Maybe they are polygraphing the cops. They didn't polygraph a lot of people. I wrote the whole list out. And nevertheless, you know, you just wonder.
That's some scary stuff. I know it diverges, but I'll keep circling it back to this, whether this is, you know, Nanos's department keeping the Bureau from investigating, or like you said, it's because of a lack of experience on the Bureau side to execute. But when you start shifting our onboarding process, which is a long, lengthy process, I don't know how long it took for you from the day you decided you wanted to apply to the day you came in. Mine was about a year, which includes three phases, and that the critical phase was the interview, as well as the polygraph phase. And it's a lifestyle polygraph. And I mean, when I was in, because I worked the counterintelligence side, we actually caught trying to come in Chinese intelligence officers that actually were part of and they actually made it to Quantico before they discovered it and booted out. So you eliminate a lifestyle polygraph with those critical questions of who you were really working for. We might have some real big issues there.
Yeah, you know, and I don't know if they've done it across the board now, but they definitely have gotten rid of it in certain circumstances. And yeah, I did a whole section on that.
Okay. So Jen, do you think it's an issue with Nanos' department, the Bureau side, or maybe a combination of both? Or like someone put in a tweet here, you know, maybe they know who it is and they're just waiting for them to slip up.
Well, that's what we all hope. We hope it's a Koberger just 5 months more out, right? Instead of being at 5 weeks, that, you know, it's going to happen, but they actually know it. This is my problem with believing that. You can't keep a killer, a murderer, most likely, an abductor on the streets and not be getting him off. And that's why you saw the blitzkrieg that happened at the beginning.
Right.
Because they realized, well, also they had hope that Nancy was alive. But in addition to that, are people safe?
Right.
I mean, who else is going to get kidnapped? I mean, I'm telling you, if I had any wealth and lived in Tulsa, I would be getting major security incorporated in my home.
Yeah, typically in these cases, when the only reason to not arrest someone if they're trying to go for someone bigger, because they're trying to develop that conspiracy, the web of all the tendrils that go out from the one individual they do know about. But I'm with you. When it comes down to life and a threat of violence against another human being, no one ever waits on anything. They're going to remove that person from the road. So with that, make sure you hit like and follow wherever you get your podcast. That wraps it up for the week. Check out Hidden Killers Live on Monday for less listener Q&A with myself and Todd and Lisa. And until then, for Jennifer, for Todd and Tony, who's on his honeymoon still, we'll be back. And he'll be back on Tuesday. I'm Robin Dreek with Hidden Killers Live. Thanks, everyone. Be safe and have a great weekend.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
He tapped on the camera first. Little taps. The way a man checks to see if something is loose. It didn't come off. So he reached over to the potted plant sitting on her front porch, pulled the leaves off of it, and used them to cover the lens. Then he went inside. Masked, armed, gloved, a backpack on his shoulders, 2 o'clock in the morning, on an 84-year-old woman's front step, calmly doing a little gardening. He wasn't rushed. He had time. And he knew he had time. He was right about that, because the two agencies that were supposed to find her have spent every day since blaming each other in public. The FBI director went on a podcast and accused the sheriff of locking him out. The sheriff, in the middle of the search, answered a reporter asking about his own record by telling him to enjoy his hit piece. Hit piece, simply describing the employment history and lies of Nanos. Nancy Guthrie was 84 years old. She had a pacemaker. She needed medical attention every day. Pima County Sheriff Chris Nano said publicly that she could not walk 50 yards by herself. At 2:28 on the morning of February 1st, the app connected to her pacemaker stopped transmitting. That's the edge of the map. Everything past 2:28 is a question nobody has answered. We welcome your thoughts in the comments section on Substack and YouTube. The links are in the description. Her blood was on that front step, confirmed as hers. Her phone was still inside the house. Her essential belongings were still inside the house. The FBI released 4 black and white images from her doorbell camera on February 10th. They described the man on her porch as roughly 5'9" to 5'10", medium build. He carried a distinctive gun holster and a 25-liter Ozark Trail backpack sold at Walmart. He may have been wearing a ring. That's the description. That's what they have. The search that followed pulled in the FBI, Customs and Border Protection, Arizona State Investigators, search and rescue teams, dogs, drones, and aircraft. Tens of thousands of tips came in. The Guthrie family offered $1 million of their own money, and the total reward combined passed $1.2 million. There is no suspect. There is no arrest. There is no Nancy. The man on that porch was the most disciplined person involved in the case, and he still is. There are 3 things here that nobody in Tucson wants to talk about. A note that arrived on the 6th of February, a glove that went for a trip, and a sentence one of these men said on live television that he can't take back. Cases like this almost never die because the person who did was brilliant. They die because the people hunting him got distracted hunting each other. It happens 4 ways. It happens the same 4 ways every time. There is the clock, and the one only hours that really belong to you are the first 48 on that clock. Then there's the ego, where somebody decides the case belongs to them. And being right quietly gets replaced by being seen to be right. There's a silo where evidence goes to the wrong lab, the wrong desk, the wrong database, and waits. And then there's the story, because when the people holding the facts go quiet, the vacuum fills with grifters. All 4 are on the record here. On the 1st of July, the FBI's Phoenix office put out a public statement on the Guthrie investigation. In it, the Bureau said local authorities remain the lead. 45 minutes later, the Pima County Sheriff's Department put out a statement of its own. It directed all questions about the ransom notes to the FBI. Same night, under an hour apart, the federal agency points at the locals and the locals point at the feds. News Nation has reported that both agencies have at times sent questions to the other and denied being the lead. Retired FBI agent Steve Moore's read is that both may be positioning to avoid getting stuck with the blame. That's two institutions playing hot potato with a missing 84-year-old woman. Catch! The day before those statements, Reuters reported that an FBI official said none of the ransom notes were believed to be genuine. A second law enforcement source confirmed it. And 24 hours later, FBI Phoenix said publicly that while some notes were extortion attempts, others may still be legitimate and are being investigated as such. The Bureau contradicted the Bureau inside of a day. Asked about it at a Justice Department briefing when they were, FBI Director Kash Patel declined to comment. Steve Moore spent 25 years inside the FBI. His assessment was that there's a significant disagreement within the investigation, right down to whether certain pieces of evidence are real. Attorney Mark Garagos went further and said he believes the story was planted by somebody inside the Bureau. And May Patel went on a podcast and criticized Nanos for sending DNA evidence to a private lab in Florida rather than the FBI lab at Quantico. He made sure the evidence, or the audience rather, knew he had a fixed-wing aircraft on the ground, fueled and ready to fly that evidence out overnight. Nanos answered that the decisions were made on scene based on operational needs and that the Florida lab in Quantico had worked in partnership from the start. Two men, one podium fight. Nancy Guthrie is still missing. But you know about the plane. Patel also took credit for the doorbell footage. He said the reason the image of the masked man exists at all is that the FBI worked with Google to recover the data. And then he added that they could have gotten it days earlier and maybe gotten more of it if they had been let in sooner. The single biggest break in this case, and it's a grievance point against the other, the glove is where this stops being a messaging problem and starts being an evidence problem. A glove was recovered roughly 2 miles from her house. Investigators believe it might match the ones worn by the man on her porch. That made it potentially the most valuable object recovered in this entire case. It went to Florida. Then it came back to Arizona to be retested. And only then was it entered into CODIS, the National DNA Database. No hit, no match against any offender in the system, and no match to the DNA found inside her home. In the end, the glove was traced to a restaurant worker employed across the street from where it was found. The Pima County Sheriff's Department publicly confirmed that that person has nothing to do with the case. Meanwhile, the unknown DNA recovered from inside Nancy's house came back as a partial profile, not enough to run against CODIS at all. Nanos told NBC News that untangling a mixed sample at the Florida lab could take weeks, months, or up to a year. Up to a year for an 84-year-old woman who was bleeding on her own front step. The fallback runs into its own wall. Ancestry, 23andMe, MyHeritage all bar law enforcement from searching their databases. The pool investigators can actually work with is actually a fraction of the size. Patel's other claim on that same podcast was that the FBI was kept out of this investigation for 4 days. He talked about how the first 48 hours are the most critical. The implication was not subtle. The sheriff shut us out, and it cost us. Nanos fired back the same day. He said he responded to the scene the night it happened. He said the FBI task force member was notified and present at the scene. He said the Bureau was notified promptly by his department and by the Guthrie family. Coordination, he said, began without a delay. Two men, two stories, that would be the end of it, except for what is already on the record from February. On February 3rd, 2 days after Nancy Guthrie was reported missing, an FBI special agent stood at a press conference in Tucson next to Sheriff Nanos. And that same day, Kash Patel went on Fox News and said about the same case that the Bureau was on the ground there with them. On the ground there with them. That's the sentence you can't take back. The claim that the FBI was locked out for 4 days is contradicted by the man who made it on camera in his own voice in February. So what if you're listening to this or watching this going, well, this seems to be a lot of contradictory information, that's the point. That is the point. That is why there is no Nancy Guthrie being found yet. Because it's contradiction after contradiction. The acting attorney general then went on television and denied there was friction at all, while acknowledging he had seen the reports of it. Three officials, same side, same 4 days, three different versions of reality. Somebody is not telling the truth. And it's not the 84-year-old woman who is still missing. The man running the search has his own credibility problem. The Arizona Republic reported that Sheriff Nano's official department resume misstated when he left the El Paso Police Department. It's good to know who you're working with, isn't it? Look at the resume. Records show he resigned in lieu of termination in 1982 after a string of disciplinary actions. In a deposition, he testified he had never been suspended, though. The records indicated otherwise. His department called it two clerical errors, administrative in nature. Oh, really? His own deputies union voted no confidence in him. The Pima County Board of Supervisors moved to compel a sworn report from him under a statute that could result in his removal from office. A recall effort was launched. And when a reporter emailed him asking about the resume the sheriff of Pima County had, the man leading the search for Nancy Guthrie wrote back one line, "Good luck with your hit piece." You get pushback when people don't want to be accountable. The first note came in on February 2nd, one day after she was reported missing. It went through tip lines to two local news stations and to TMZ, addressed to Savannah Guthrie. CBS News reported that it demanded $4 million in Bitcoin and that the price would climb by $2 million more if the first deadline passed. Investigators took it seriously for a specific reason. Whoever wrote it knew where her Apple Watch was, the one with the white band lying on the floor beside her bed. They knew the floodlight on her back porch was also burned out. Those are things, you know, apparently only if you're inside that house, or a good guess, or search the internet. The family worked with the FBI to create a response. They sent it, and nobody wrote back. Then on February 6th, a second note came in. The FBI determined it came from the same IP as the first. The note said Nancy Guthrie was dead. There was no ransom demand attached, no price, no deadline, no instructions, nothing to sell, apparently. Same source, which means the two notes are a package. Either both came from the people who took her, or neither did. There is no version of this where one is real and the other is not. It doesn't mean they lead back to the person who actually took her, though. We just know they probably came from the same source. And the Bureau has, at different moments, pointed in both directions. Reuters reported that the FBI tested the first note by depositing a small amount of cryptocurrency into the account that the note specified. The money was never touched. Nobody came for it. Her three children went in front of a camera. They held hands. They said they had received the message and understood it. They asked for their mother to be returned. They said they would pay. They were asking for a safe return of a woman that a note in a law enforcement file had already called dead. That note was not made public until June 22nd. There's a legitimate reason to hold a note like that back. You keep details private so that if people responsible make contact again, you can authenticate them against something only they would know. That's a real tactic, and pretending otherwise would be dishonest. But there's a difference between protecting an investigation and protecting yourself. Shelley McCollum, a working crime scene investigator, said on national television of that family that nobody has told them the straight-up truth. And into that silence came exactly what always comes. A man in California pled guilty to sending the family a fake ransom demand. Somebody began running a QR code scam using a missing woman's face, and the sheriff's department had to publicly announce it would never ask anyone for money. A YouTuber was arrested live streaming on her front lawn. The internet turned on her own children until Nanos had to stand up and call that speculation cruel. That's not a coincidence. That's a consequence. So look at what this case actually had. Savannah Guthrie co-hosts the highest-rated morning show in America. Her family put up $1 million of their own money. The FBI director posted the surveillance images to his own social media account. The White House posted about her. The reward passed $1.2 million. Tens of thousands of tips came in. That's the ceiling. There is no higher gear. There is nothing above it. And what it brought was two agencies pointing at each other and a glove that flew to Florida and came back. It brought a partial profile nobody can run and a note that sat in a file for 4.5 months. It brought a sheriff answering questions about his own resume and a director talking about his jet. The pattern is not theoretical. In Suffolk County, New York, the chief of police moved to cut the FBI out of the Gilgo Beach investigation. He signaled a directive requiring his own officers to notify a supervisor if an outside agency contacted them. Former FBI agent who later ran that department said his decision to push the bureau out likely hurt the effort to catch that killer. That chief went to federal prison, not for anything to do with the Gilgo Beach case. He went away for 46 months for beating a handcuffed man and orchestrating a cover-up. He was gone. A real task force with the FBI was finally built. And that is when they arrested Rex Ehrman. There's no conspiracy in Tucson. Nobody's hiding Nancy Guthrie. What happened here is more ordinary than a conspiracy, and it's worse. A federal director who wanted to win. A sheriff who wanted the turf. A field office that does not appear to agree with its own headquarters. Evidence that took a flight it never should have taken. And a family standing in a doorway, waiting for one adult in the room to walk up and tell them the truth. Incompetence does not need a motive. That is what makes it so hard to fight. There's nobody to indict for it. There's no perp walk at the end of it. There's just a woman who never came home. Savannah Guthrie stood on national television and begged strangers to come forward. She said her family was in agony. That's the word she used. Nancy Guthrie was 84 years old. She had a pacemaker. She needed her medication. Her family dropped her off at her own front door at night at around 9:45. And she went inside her own house and she never saw the morning. She was bleeding when she left it. Every day these two agencies spend deciding who gets to stand at the microphone is another day. The man on that porch sleeps through the night. The only person in this entire story who has shown any discipline at all is the one who stood on her front step and picked the leaves. Nancy Guthrie is not a jurisdictional dispute. She's not a press release. She's not a line item in somebody's resume fight. She's an 84-year-old woman who walked into her own house and never walked out of it. And every institution that was supposed to bring her home has been too busy fighting over the credit to do it. She is still missing. That's the only fact that matters in this case. Your thoughts on the dysfunction of this case? Or is it not dysfunction? Is this all being overplayed? Is everything, are we focusing too much on the dysfunction? And not enough on the suspect? I don't know. I don't know the answer to that question. When there's not a lot of information, you try to fill in the blanks. But I think observationally, the dysfunction here is likely part of the reason we don't have any answers as well. If you have any information, call 1-800-CALL-FBI. 1-800-CALL-FBI. Look forward to continuing our conversation in the comments section. Links are in the description. Until then, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.